Today on The Grave Talks, shapeshifters. There is something about a shapeshifter, a person who can transform into an animal internally or externally, that captures our imagination. It causes us to want to howl at the moon or flit through the night like a bat. Werewolves, vampires, demons, other strange supernatural creatures appeal to our animal nature, our dark side, our desire to break free of our bonds of society and proper behavior. Real or imaginary, shapeshifters lurk deep in our psyches and remain formidable cultural icons. Today, we dive into the world of shapeshifters, what they are, and how they affect society. It's a conversation with author John Kashuba.
Basically, you know, as you know, I've done a lot of work with ghost books and things like that.
Sure.
And it seems like every time I do a talk about ghosts, somebody in the audience has a question that when I hear it, I think, you know, they're really not talking about a ghost. They're talking about shapeshifters. And my classic understanding of shapeshifters was sort of the werewolf, vampire kind of stereotype that we all know. But I started looking into it because I thought there must be more behind it. And when I started doing that, I mean, I found shapeshifters from antiquity, from prehistoric times, you know, all the way up to today, from cultures all around the world, and an entire range of types and characteristics of shapeshifters. So it was far beyond just the werewolf and vampire. And it just was so fascinating. I thought, you know, I've got to write about this. There's just too much here.
Sure. I mean, when you think of things like werewolf or vampire, it conjures up not a lot of seriousness for most when you're thinking of ghosts or paranormal, as serious as that world can get. A lot of that is still looked upon as, well, that's, you know, fairy tale. That's something that, you know, maybe there have been people who have sucked people's blood, but not necessarily, you know, your true, you know, in the castle, Dracula, I mean, yes, Dracula existed, but not the personified cartoon version that we think about. You know, same with werewolves. You know, some will go into that world of cryptoids, and there's more Bigfoot things like that that are talked about. But as far as the, you know, mythical werewolf, the mythical vampire, things of that nature, what were you thinking going into this as far as the, I guess, validity of some of these characters being something?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, validity is a tricky word.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean the same thing as real.
Sure.
Or unreal. You know, and what I found out was that, yes, there is sort of the popular culture of the old, you know, the original Lon Chaney Jr. Wolfman movie right up to today, and the Bela Lugosi Draculas up to today, and mm-hmm. the vampires. Things like that. But in looking at this, Tony, what I found out was that the shapeshifters were very, again, I will say real for a lot of cultures. If you look back in ancient mythology, if you look back in Greek and Roman culture, so many of their gods and goddesses were capable of shapeshifting. And to us, yeah, these are stories. These are like, you know, myths, as we say, right?
Mm-hmm.
But for the people of the time, this was not mythology. These were not myths. These were their gods and goddesses. This was fact. This was religion for them.
Yeah.
So for them, the idea of shapeshifting was very much a real thing. It exists in a lot of cultures today, especially some of the more indigenous cultures in different countries. You have things like the skinwalkers among the Native Americans in the Southwest here. I've got a lot of stories in my book from Africa and India and places where, you know, kind of remote locations where people are having experiences and witnessing events that they say are shape-shifting events and shape-shifting experiences. So the validity of it, if you want to call it that, is there.
Mm-hmm.
There is certainly that popular culture. Yeah, okay, it's a funny kind of werewolf. You know, I think of,
sure,
what was that movie? I was a teenage werewolf,
yeah,
you know?
Sure.
Which, yeah, I mean, that was funny. It was campy. You know, okay, no one buys into that. But what do you do with stories reported, like even in the New York Times, about werewolves in India?
Sure.
You know, and I have that story in my book. I mean, so So there is something there other than just this sort of, I don't want to say even comic, but sort of this make-believe attitude about them. Like, oh yeah, they're just fairy tales and stories. There is some underlying documentation. I don't want to say truth, but documentation under that.
Yeah, I'm curious about that because in many cultures, many religions, many belief systems, there are stories of just that, of shape-shifting people, things, events, where that happens. And that's a lot of times where it ends. It is in the literature, the mythology, the canon, whatever you want to call it, of said thing that you're looking at. Where was it that when you were looking into this that you started to see, okay, this goes beyond the canon of a certain religion or a certain belief system? This is starting, I'm starting to find some evidence. I'm starting to find some interesting stories here that take it beyond just the long ago lore that is passed down from generation to generation, but more so, oh no, this happened, you know, when we say recent times, we can open up that window to the last, you know, 100, 200 years, you know, but what were you finding in that sort of a time window?
Well, there were two things. One thing that I found, as you say, even in the last, 100 years, maybe to 200 years, like late 19th century, mid 19th century, up to probably, early 20th century, documented cases that I put in my book, Shapeshifters, about people who were convinced that they had converted into some kind of animal, primarily a wolf. So they're called, lycanthropes. And they were actually suffering from a disease that psychiatrists now call lycanthropy. But these were people who, some of them were violent. Some of them would attack people, believing entirely that they were in wolf form. And would go around, on all fours. They'd be growling. They'd snap. They'd eat like animals, and obviously most of these people ended up in mental hospitals. And some of them committed crimes in that sort of guise. Although, you're looking at them, nothing happens that we can see, but somehow internally they've done this. So somehow the whole shapeshifter mystique, if you will, had entered into our global consciousness to the point where some people, albeit maybe with a disturbed mentality, took on that persona and said, yes, this is me. I'm a shapeshifter. I'm now a wolf, So that was one thing. But the second thing that I alluded to a little bit earlier was when I started doing some research and getting reports from, Africa and India and even, England, places like that, within the last probably 50 years of documented sightings where people have actually seen, not just maybe seen something that looked like a wolf man, running in the distance or something, but actually had close-up experiences where they saw or said they saw actual transformations. And I can think of a story from Africa, and I cannot remember the country, unfortunately. It's in my book. I think it may have been Kenya, but, people, when they get shapeshifters, can look it up and find out for themselves. But the story, and this was reported in the newspapers, was that there was a guy in a small village who woke up one night because he heard sort of scratching and banging on his door of his hut. And he opened it, and he found this large bat, a sort of giant-sized bat, not man-sized, but an extremely large bat, hanging from the rafters or over the door. And, he was frightened, and he grabbed a stick or a club, and he started just, wailing away at this thing, beating it, and it flew off. He got the villagers up and aroused and said, hey, we got to go get this thing. And they chased after it. They found it straggling sort of across the ground, looked like he had, severely wounded it. And they surrounded it, and it just kind of dropped and laid still. The story says, the newspaper account says, that as they watched it, as they stood there looking at it, and by the way, the guy with the club whacked it a couple more times just to make sure, but they said that as they stood there watching it, they said it transformed. They said at first it looked like it was transforming into a donkey, but they said, no, it started to transform into what looked like a child, and then that even metamorphosed more into finally transforming into an old man. And they recognized the old man as being sort of their local shaman or wise man of their village. So according to the report, I mean, these people saw this transformation. The guy, and of course, unfortunately, this poor guy was dead. So the man who killed him went to trial and was convicted for killing him. But the judge had an interesting little comment, and he said that, you know, you should have been able to know the difference between a man and a bat. And apparently he didn't. But, you know, here's a case where you had people, whether we believe it or not, you know, it's reported in the newspaper, people saw this and they swear by that. And there was a similar story in the New York Times about some incidents in a remote area of India called Uttar Pradesh. It's kind of a remote province, I think, up in the northern part of India, pretty close to, I think, like the Pakistani border. And they were saying that up there, as many as 33 children disappeared, just seemed to disappear. And people were saying that they were seeing what they were describing as kind of a wolf man in the area, and they were attributing it to that. Hysteria broke out, and they actually lynched 25 different villagers that they thought were practicing witchcraft and were transforming themselves into wolves to snatch these children. New York Times went there, and they talked to people, and they got firsthand reports from like a 10-year-old girl who said that she saw her little 4-year-old brother. She saw something that she described as a wolf grab her brother, throw him over its shoulder, and run off on two legs with the kid. So these are stories that are reported, you know, in the paper, that people are witnessing this kind of stuff. I have no idea what they're seeing or what they're reporting, but, you know, when I read things like that, I say, okay, something is going on. I can't claim to know what it is, but there is definitely something happening.
A lot of facets here that we should unpack. I want to ask first kind of what we were just talking about. And I know this is just an opinion-based question, but we're talking about shape-shifting, and quite often it sounds like it's a living being that is having this happen to them. It's not necessarily just there's this entity that comes out of nowhere and does it, although in some cases that is what happens. I guess the question is, what causes shape shifting when we're talking about a living being, someone who is a person, who is the story you said earlier of the kind of the local, the older gentleman who shape shifted into a bat and then was killed and then the man went to trial. Is it the practice of something? Is there something else? What's your thoughts on that?
Right. And I wish I had a good answer, but I can give you an illustration that might help. There's a man here in Northern Ohio named Guy Savelli. And Guy is a master of kind of an obscure martial arts. I can't remember the name of it, but it's a pretty, you know, small practice of martial arts. But he's a master in this stuff. And in fact, he's worked with special forces, with some of the special ops, Navy SEALs teams, things like that, to teach them the martial arts. But he also does a lot with mind control. And there was a book that came out that was later made into a movie, and the book was titled, I may get it a little bit wrong, but something about the men who stare at goats.
Okay.
Yeah, and the idea was that there was a team actually being trained by the U.S. military to do mind control. And Guy Savelli was the person who was leading this thing, and supposedly he was able to knock a goat down from 50 yards away while he was in another room entirely, but just with his mind, just thinking about it, and floored this goat. Okay. Now, so, and this is all documented in the book and as well as the movie. But what happened was one of his students told me that he and Guy were in a bar someplace, and that, you know, they were just minding their own business. And this person who had gotten a little bit, had a couple too many drinks in him, kind of came up to Savelli and for whatever reason just got in his face. And Guy just kind of stood there and looked at him. And this drunk was a big belligerent guy. And the student who was standing there watching this said that he watched Guy Savelli, and he said, all I know is, he said, I can't explain what happened. But in his words, he said it was like a tiger had entered the room. He said, I saw an expression on Savelli's face. It changed. It changed to, he said, for lack, I can only call it a tiger. He said he looked like a tiger. And the short of it is that this guy who was ready to, you know, throw a punch just looked at Savelli and basically just like turned white and just turned and ran away. And that was it. And the student says, I don't know what happened, but I saw this. I saw this interaction. I saw this transformation, if you will. And Savelli, you know, being a master of mind control, that he's very much into meditation and a lot of sort of mental exercises. So is there something like that? Is that how maybe some of the shamans that talk about transforming and taking, you know, journeys as a bird or a wolf or something and then coming back to themselves? Is that how it's done? Is it done through mental exercises? I mean, that's a possibility for it. And if you can do it mentally, and here's a real stretch, can you actually do it physically? You know?
Yeah, that's what I wonder about. Is it something where there's so much energy being protruded from an individual that then the rest of us who are there to witness these things are then picking up on this as they are actually physically changing, you know, or is it more in the realm of an optical illusion of some sort that this is what our minds then perceive because of what is happening? And there's been obviously been many cases when it comes to hauntings of people talking about transformation of an individual changing their looks and then snapping back to their themselves. The one I guess I would naturally go to, one of the most well-known in popular culture, would be talking about the Amityville Horror case, where George recounts and recounted till his death that there was a time where Kathy, his wife, transformed in front of him into an what you would consider or call at the time an old hag, is how he described it. Literally, her face changed in front of him to this old, decrepit looking woman, and it stayed that way for a short period of time and then went away. So in a way, some sort of shape shifting going on amongst a myriad of other activity going on in that case.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think, you know, my personal belief is that I think it might be possible for people who have some really strong, strong mental abilities to maybe, as you say, you know, sort of give that impression to somebody. Maybe it's an illusion, maybe it's more than illusion, but I find it a little bit difficult to believe that somebody would actually physically grow claws and fur and yeah, fangs, and then, you know, but can you get that impression? Can you give that impression to somebody else? I think that's possible. We know about mass hysteria where, you know, people, crowds of people will say they saw a flying saucer, or they saw a monster or something. And we know that wasn't there, that there was something gave them that impression, gave them that illusion, but it wasn't necessarily what they thought.
Yeah. And memory can obviously be a very tricky thing. I mean, if you look at the science of it, and when you are taking everything into account and you're looking back at what you believe you remembered, your mind has to rebuild that every single time based on data. There's no, your mind, as much as we think of it as being a tape recorder of events, is the shittiest tape recorder you could get. It's worse than beta.
That's true. And I read someplace that every time you recall a memory, it's recalled differently. You may not be aware of that.
Yeah.
But then, like, every time you call it up, there's a little alteration. So after, you know, 20, 30 times or whatever, you might be pretty far from what that original memory actually was.
You're exactly right. I mean, I guess a fun analogy on that would be, okay, so the real thing that happened would be the real life event. The second recall of the memory is the actual cinematic movie that's made about it for the theaters. The next time it's recalled, you're kind of taking it back. It's the one that came out about 20 years later in 1988 and aired on ABC on Sunday night. And after that, then it goes to, well, it came to the VHS only release a couple years later, and then the remake of that, and then eventually your recall on it all those years later is, you know, three kids down the road reenacting it on YouTube. And that's that's how memory works.
Yeah, I think you're right.
It's like, here's how accurate it is. But it's interesting because we don't recognize all those nuances of difference when it comes to recalling things. Right. We still are going to see the version where it's the three kids down the road reenacting it as if it were happening this way with cardboard boxes. And our reality, what we're perceiving is still, this is what happened. This is how it is. which is something that we need to take into account. I guess I'm curious about when we're talking about shape-shifting. I know that one of the more common ones, and you had alluded to it earlier in the conversation, was the wolf. And that being a fairly common thing that people have stories of shape-shifting too. And if I can say this correctly, I'm horrible at words, lycanthropy, am I saying that right? Lycanthropy?
Lycanthropy, yeah.
Okay, there we go.
You got it.
When there's a new word introduced into my lexicon, I screw it up the first 20 times. Let's talk about that for a moment, lycanthropy. And its origins in... what people talked about with it is the mythical aspects of it, and then the factual aspects of what it actually is as a condition. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, I think, first of all, the very first animal domesticated by man thousands and thousands of years ago was a wolf that became a dog, right? I mean, dog breeds were not specific to themselves. They all stem from wolf. So really early on in our human history, we had some affinity for wolves, and we were able to domesticate some, but we still have wild wolves, obviously, right? So we weren't able to totally take that species and turn it into domesticated animal, but we did with some. But I guess where I'm going with that is that if you look at a dog, you know, dogs are very, man's best friend, right? I mean, we get along very well with dogs for the most part. We don't get along with wolves. But I wonder if the reason why we get along with dogs so much is because they can intuit our moods, our emotions, our feelings, and sort of react correspondingly, and vice versa. I think we can sort of see, you know, our dog seems sad or, you know, whatever. But we don't do that with wolves. But I do think that if you go back to this connection, this might be like a really early even reason why, if we talk about shape-shifting, we would talk about shape-shifting into a wolf, simply because I think we may have this sort of, it's not a genetic affinity, but sort of a cultural affinity for this one particular animal that goes back, you know, thousands and thousands of years. But as for the other part of, you know, what happens to it, I don't know what the other causes might be for lycanthropy, and I'm not sure anybody has really figured that out. For instance, why the examples that I gave, why is it that these people feel that they change into wolves? Why doesn't one say, you know, I'm going to change into a chipmunk, you know, and run around like a chipmunk and be, you know, put in a hospital for that? They don't. It's all wolves. And I don't know, I don't have an answer for that. I wish I did, but I just keep going back to this idea, this ancient idea of a primitive animal, a wild animal that somehow bonds with us and we bond with it. And you wonder how close that bond is.
What about the actual medical condition of lycanthropy that people have tried to explain, tried to do some research on? Obviously, people are not physically turning into werewolves. It's not right. Michael J. Fox, doing this. What exactly is it, when someone is going through that and they have this belief in their mind that they are turning into a wolf, or that they are a wolf? They're, I guess the 2020 term is, I'm identifying as a wolf. Has there been anything else that goes along with it other than identifying as a wolf? Is there anything where the medical condition comes into play of, for example, extreme hair growth, things of that nature? Because there have been, and there are obviously, conditions where that happens. It used to be relegated to what was called at the time circus freak shows, and there were men who just had this crazy conditions that they grew so much hair that they, it's wolf man, but really it was a medical condition. But with lycanthropy, is there anything where anything physical occurs?
Right. Well, and I'm glad you brought that up with that other, I can't think of the medical term for it. I want to say it's like hyper-hirsutism, but I might be wrong on that. But in any case, you know, the idea of having extreme hair, like the hairy lady in the circus or whatever.
Hypertrichosis.
I think that a lot of a lot of cases, you know, years ago, centuries ago, when people were, you know, pretty ignorant of it, if they saw somebody like that, they might automatically think, oh yeah, that's a wolf, that's a wolf man. But I don't think, yeah, you're right. So if somebody is suffering from lycanthropy, they don't turn into a wolf. We don't see, you know, we don't see them growing, you know, claws or fangs or anything else. But not only is it a mental condition where they simply believe that they are wolves, I mean, they act out on it, which is the bad part. And if you go back to like the 18th century, I have some cases in my book, 18th and actually 17th century, in Germany and in France, there were several cases of people who killed other people, you know, literally with their bare hands. I mean, tore other people apart with their bare hands, children, women, and ate them, cannibalism. I mean, you know, savaged the bodies, ate them, thinking all the time that they were wolves doing this. And when they were caught and brought to justice, I mean, they considered themselves to be wolves. They just thought they were wolves. So there was this acting out on it. Now, it doesn't happen all the time, and I'm not even sure when the last case of lycanthropy was even recorded. I have a feeling it's probably been quite some time. But it is a recognized, you know, psychiatric disorder.
It's 2020. Give it a week. If people are identifying as toasters, it's not that far of a stretch to be a wolf.
Yeah, that's for sure.
In your belief, when it came to these conditions and people identifying as wolves and doing these horrendous things that had been documented and somebody saying, I think I'm a wolf, is, in your belief, from the research that you've done, and this is just an opinion, do you think it was a mental condition that someone was suffering from, or do you think there was something supernatural at play, allowing someone to do such heinous things and operate in this bizarre belief that they are a wolf? Was something else taking them over to do something like that?
Well, you know, it's interesting because some of the cases that I mentioned, especially like from the 17th century, they would sometimes say when they were on trial that they were under the influence. Like, I remember one case where somebody said that he was in the forest and he met what he called, he said, a black man. And he didn't mean necessarily, you know, facial or mm-hmm. racial. He meant this guy was black, like a Satan or satanic figure.
Okay.
And he said that the guy gave him some kind of a magic, like a belt to wear. It was the belt of a wolf hide, and that if he wore that, he'd have all these powers and everything else. Another person said that he was given some kind of potion by somebody. So they had that. Some of these people had that belief that there was something supernatural going on, that they were influenced by somebody. But, you know, I mean, when we read it today, it's hard to believe that any of that actually happened. I mean, to me, I'm just thinking that these were mental conditions for the most part. They fully believed it. So if they believed that it was reality for them, but, you know, for the rest of us, we're saying, nah, you probably didn't really meet a you know, stranger in the forest that gave you a magic belt that changed you into a wolf, but yet you thought you did. So there's that.
Yeah, it's where if you're going to go to the length of doing these horrible things and believe you're a wolf, it's not a far stretch to have that individual say they met a man in the woods that gave them a magic belt.
Right, right. Okay. And, you know, sometimes if you look at people, well, some people, for instance, let's say take drugs like PCP or something like that, mm-hmm. which is, you know, not to use that anymore, but I know some police officers who have dealt with guys who have been on PCP, and they say they're incredibly strong and violent, you know, because of the drug, mm-hmm. because something in their body does that to them. So is it possible that maybe you can enter a mental state that also gives you that sort of extra physical strength or whatever that would allow you to attack somebody in that way and savage them or whatever? You know, that might be possible as well.
It makes you wonder, especially when we talk about these sort of events that occurred such a long distance in time in the past, about a substance of some sort that was influencing sometimes a single individual to go and do these things. But even when you have a small group that then recounts to people after the fact saying, no, we saw this happen. We saw this person turn into a bat or whatever it may be. You have to wonder, Well, did someone grab the wrong mushrooms for dinner tonight?
Right.
And was everyone under a psychedelic influence or some sort of psychosis because of the diet of what was being consumed? Because obviously there are plenty of things out there in our own backyards, or go for a walk in the woods. You eat the wrong thing, like, don't touch that. That could kill you. That could really mess you up. And there was no FDA. There was nobody controlling these things or substances. And unless you had the knowledge from another person of you should eat this and you shouldn't eat that, it would be fairly easy to fall in the trap of consuming something that could alter your mental state for a short period of time. And if you didn't know any better, you could then, you know, recount those moments as being a paranormal experience. And that's not to discount ghostly experiences or paranormal experiences, but I think sometimes when we look back at some of these more fantastical moments, especially when we're talking about things like shapeshifters, you almost wonder, is it something as simple as, well, when this was recounted, they ate the bad berries? And they didn't ever take that into account.
Right. Well, and if you look at some of the shamans in indigenous cultures, they are using mushrooms, or they are using peyote, they're using ayahuasca. You know, I mean, they are using these agents that do alter their consciousness and change it. One example I have in my book goes way back to like the early 100s or so, in the Icelandic areas, where there were these warriors known as berserkers, you know, from which we get our present term berserk, to go crazy. Mm-hmm. And these guys were ferocious. They divided into either bear clan or wolf clan, and they would wear the pelts of those animals when they went into battle. But before they went into battle, they'd go through all these rituals, and part of that would include mushrooms, you know, the magic mushrooms.
Sure.
And when they were on those, they were incredible. They were ferocious, and they would just strike down anything in their way, friend or foe. I mean, you had to give them a lot of elbow room, you know.
Yeah.
And they believed they were in the form of a bear or a wolf entering into battle, and just were ferocious.
Yeah. It's just something that I think we oftentimes don't take into account when we're looking that far back into history and into these, you know, oddities that we have out there. That wraps up part one of our conversation with author John Kashuba. Be sure to check out his book, Shapeshifters, available wherever books are sold. In part two of our conversation, we will talk about skinwalkers and what they can do. Are there certain times in history where the rough concept of shapeshifting rises in popularity because of how the world is going? Does John believe cryptoids could be a type of shapeshifter? What kind of examples of shapeshifting has John found in more recent times? What was the most chilling story that John came across when doing research for his book about shapeshifters? All of that and more in part two of our conversation with John Kashuba about shapeshifters. To hear it, become a Gravekeeper. That's a supporter of our program. Sign up to become one on our website. Go to thegravetalks.com and click Become a Gravekeeper, or directly through Patreon and the Patreon app. Go to patreon.com/thegravetalks. $5 a month gets you access to all of our episodes in their entirety, part one and part two. You also get advanced access to our episodes every single week, months before they're released to the public, and it's all commercial free. Check it out, patreon.com/thegravetalks, to get access to all of our bonus content, support our program, and keep us on the air. Without the support of our gravekeepers, this show would not exist. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.